Please stand by. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the DB2 Chat with the Lab Series conference call. Today's call is being recorded. There is a PowerPoint presentation of charts. If you do not have the charts, you can download them from ibm.com/db2/labchats. Again, that is ibm.com/db2/labchats. At this time, for opening remarks and introductions, I would like to turn the call over to Sal Vella, VP of DB2 Development for Linux, Unix, and Windows and Business Intelligence. Please go ahead, sir.
I'm very happy to be hosting this DB2 Chat with the Labs. This is the first of the series in 2007, and I'd like to welcome you with a happy new year, both Western and Chinese, for this week. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us on this call. I want to acknowledge the support of IDUG, the International DB2 Users Group, in getting the word out for this call. We continue to see some great progress with deployment of DB29. I'll read you a couple of quotes. First from Lee Hungu of the Catholic Medical Center, who writes, "Now that we can store XML data directly on our DB29 data server, we've been able to streamline access to medical records and improve care to our patients, all while reducing storage costs with deep compression features." And from Michael Henson of SunTrust Bank, who writes, "With DB29, we're seeing compression rates of up to 83% on the data warehouse tables. The projected cost savings are more than $2 million U.S. initially, with ongoing savings of $500,000 per year." The next release, codenamed Viper 2, is moving along nicely in development. This new release will build on the features of DB29. We're gearing up for the closed beta at the moment, and if you're interested in working with this beta and providing us feedback, please work with your IBM representative to enroll in the program. I also want to tell you about a podcast series where you can get even more information about topics such as XBRL, table partitioning, pure XML, and Quest Toad for DB2. The address for this site is www.ibm.com/software/data/db2/podcast. Today's chat with the lab is entitled Zen and the Art of Performance, and it's all about dealing with the issues of more applications, higher data volumes, and more users on your database servers, all of which leads to stress on the servers and may require to deal with performance problems. This session will provide you with a logical step-by-step approach to finding and fixing performance bottlenecks anywhere in the system. It starts with common symptoms and works to solutions by using a systematic approach. And I'd like to introduce the speaker for today. Steve Reese is the senior manager responsible for performance in DB2. He's been a part of the DB2 for Linux, Unix, and Windows team for over 15 years and was a founding member of the DB2 team. He's worked in development and porting, and for the past 8 years, he's been a manager in a DB2 performance team. During that time, he's been involved in a large number of customer and internal benchmark projects and has helped develop many performance best practices. Many thanks again, and enjoy the presentation.
Thanks very much, Sal. I'd like to welcome everybody as well to this chat with the lab this afternoon. My name is Steve Reese. The title, Zen and the Art of Database Performance, may sound a bit strange, but I wanted to distinguish what we're going to be talking about here this afternoon from there's a lot of great performance information out there, through IDUG and different sources and your colleagues, et cetera. But I wanted to put together a presentation that talks about how to take all that information and put it together in a way, how to use it most effectively in a methodical way, rather than just kind of trying things, without a lot of good reason to try them, in terms of when fixing things when performance problems occur. So I'm going to be going through the PDF charts. There's both PDF charts and PowerPoint slideshow charts. Originally, this started out with a fair bit of animation, so if you're going through the slideshow, you might see some of that, and it might help make some of the material a bit clearer. I'm going to stick with the PDF. That's kind of the lowest common denominator of animation technology, as in none. And also in the PDFs, you'll find there's pretty detailed speaker notes on most of the pages. So if you after the call you have questions, you want to go back and review things, there's more information there for you to read if you like. And as well, there should be time for a question and answer at the end of the call. I'm just going to move on to slide number two, which is the agenda. We're going to start off by talking about the motivation for the talk, why in particular we want to step back and look at this different approach rather than just kind of look at new features and functions, etc. We're going to talk about being prepared for performance problems before they occur. We're going to talk about system bottlenecks and how to determine what kind of bottleneck you might be experiencing and then how to address it through, depending on what type of bottleneck it is, how to sort of refine the diagnosis and then responding to the problem. Moving on to slide number three. So why are we having this session? It's a beautiful day here in Toronto. I think if you are here in Toronto, like I am, it's you might rather spend your time outside in the first warmth we've had all year. But this can be pretty important stuff. Performance problems can be sneaky, frankly. Functional problems can be tricky too. But then at least you have SQL codes and db2diag.log and messages and all kinds of things to help you solve functional problems. Performance problems can be a little bit more difficult to diagnose. They can occur anywhere in the system, and it really helps to have an organized approach to that. If you're new to this, some of the common responses that I've seen are, panic, buying more hardware, and, I am an IBM stockholder, so I don't mind if you want to buy more IBM hardware, but let's not go there right away. Let's look at how we can solve these problems quickly and easily in the environment that you have. Number four on my list here is throwing darts at the problem. And by that I just mean, you read about something maybe in DB2 magazine or you hear it from a colleague or hear it at a conference about, a problem and a symptom and a potential problem. And then you might try things, if you're pressed for time, if things are urgent, you might try things almost at random. And we don't want to do that. We want to talk about how to step back and solve things in a kind of a more organized way. Moving on to slide number four. So, what's wrong with throwing darts? It may work for you. If it does, if you get it right in the first, couple of throws of darts, then that's a good thing. But there are a lot of cons. I mean, it's not like real darts. In this case, the bullseye is moving around and the lights are out and there's a crosswind and there's all kinds of things that make it extra challenging. So, if we really want to stress this darts analogy, we want to get as close to the dartboard as possible and control all the factors. Moving on to slide number five, here's where the Zen factor comes in, really. We're going to talk about a sort of a more, quote-unquote, enlightened strategy. We want to be structured. We want to be methodical. We want to have a sort of a decision tree approach, and that's what we're going to grow today is that decision tree. We want to start off by being prepared. We want to know how the system is supposed to work. How does it behave when the performance is good? When a problem does happen, We want to make sure that we take some time to gather and think about the symptoms. We want to observe the data. We're going to focus as well on, in sort of computer science terms, we'll talk about binary searching the problem space. Basically, what we want to do is look at the symptoms that we have and rule out possible causes that don't match with that symptom. If you have a sore foot and go to the doctor, he's probably not going to give you stomach medicine. So in the same sense, if we have a problem with I/O, we're not going to look at solutions which are going to improve CPU utilization. As we go through, we're going to make one or more hypotheses. We want to change one thing at a time. If you've ever taken any science courses in school or university, the benefits of having a hypothesis, changing one thing at a time, observing the effect, and repeating the process. And it may seem like a roundabout way to get to the final solution, but in the end, it'll end up helping you solve the problem more quickly. On page six, this just gives an example of kind of what our decision tree is going to look like. We're starting at the bottom where we have this, what kind of bottleneck are we looking at the root of our tree? And then we're going to grow up into four distinct branches today. Is it a CPU bottleneck? Is it a disk bottleneck? A network bottleneck? Or what I call a lazy system, and I'll get to what that means a little bit later. These are kind of the four basic kinds of bottleneck that we can run into. And just like if you've ever played 20 questions, the first thing you do, if you're a good 20 questions player like my kids are, they start off by saying, "Well, is it animal, vegetable, or mineral?" Because they're not going to guess in one category, in a different category once they know what the right category is. They start off with dividing down the possible answers ruling out as many wrong answers as possible, as early as possible, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to grow this decision tree, what we call depth first. We're going to start off with CPU bottlenecks. We're going to drill down into this leftmost pink subtree. We're going to look at all the different possible. Actually, no, we're going to start with disk bottlenecks, pardon me. But we are going to drill down into each of these individually as we go. On slide number 7, we talk about being prepared for performance problems. This is a really important thing. Kind of step 0, and it's not our focus today, but we got to have a good basic configuration that we start with. There's lots of good sources of information on the web at iDug. The DB2 Auto Configure tool is a great way of getting a sane configuration as you start. And then just like, you know, for properly diagnosing any problem, performance problems included, require that you know what the system looks like when it's healthy. You know, for example, you know you have a fever when your temperature is above 98.6 if you're in the U.S. or 37 degrees if you're in Canada or whatever, but you know what that baseline temperature is. Similarly, in a system like DB2, we have to know what the baseline performance is like. So we're going to talk about collecting some basic data when the system is well so that we have something to compare against when it's not. On page 8, we talk about what data you might need. Two basic types, configuration data, for example, we could use database and database manager configuration parameters, registry variables, environment variables, the schema definition collected with DB2 look, disk configuration, how much memory is in the machine, the types of CPUs, etc. All that kind of basic configuration data. As well, we also need to know how that performs. We need runtime data, for example, application throughput and response time. We get DB2 snapshots. Make sure to turn on all the switches so that you get buffer pool, a lock information sort, etc., etc. Even event monitor data, which it's going to be able to time, you know, for example, deadlocks or statement execution times can be very useful later on. Statement plans, execution plans for the SQL, either we can get through DB2 EXFMT in the explain table or DB2 explain. On top of that, operating system data, like how much CPU we're using. Am I using, when my system is healthy, am I using 70% CPU or 80% or 60%? How busy are my disks? Those kinds of things can be very, very valuable information, not only for diagnosing performance problems, but for capacity planning, for detecting long-term trends in system usage, etc. We want to make sure that we look at those at both average and peak time. So on page 9, we talk about, well, finally, we're 9 pages into the presentation and a performance problem is developed. Now what do we do? Probably the most important thing we need to understand was, has anything been intentionally changed on the system since the performance was acceptable? You know, have new applications been deployed? Do I have other non-DB2 workloads on the system? Do I have more users, more data? Were there any software configuration changes, like, for example, parameters or installing fix packs, etc.? What about hardware configuration changes? So if we can identify the root cause right up front, then, you know, we're halfway there. If this is something that we can change, for example, is something being unintentionally run on my database system that's causing a performance slowdown, if it's something I can undo, that's great, I'm done. The problem is solved. But most of the time, problems like this are things that we have to live with. And that, on the left-hand side of the page, you'll notice there's a box that says real problem and a guy scratching his head standing next to it. All the way through the presentation, I'm basically showing the growth of the decision tree that we're on. Sort of, we start at the bottom here. Is it a real problem? Do we know whether or not? And we'll just grow the decision tree kind of up the left-hand side of the page. So you'll always know in that large decision tree, within the scope of that large decision tree we talked about at the beginning, what branch are we in and how did we get there? So on page 10, what basic kind of bottleneck is it? So this is sort of the 20 questions kind of thing. We want to look at a couple of major different types of bottlenecks, either a resource bottleneck or a non-resource bottleneck. And a resource bottleneck is basically just a shortage of something that we need. For example, the big one on many database systems tends to be disk. So if I have a disk bottleneck, the basic symptoms of that, I'm going to see I/O wait time in tools like VMstat and IOstat, etc. I/O wait is simply the case where the machine has nothing else to do but wait for an I/O to complete. It can't do any useful work, so it's just waiting for that data to either be written to the disk or read from the disk. Is the disk maybe more than, say, 80% busy? Now, that's a good sign of a disk bottleneck. We can also see long device queues. If you're on Windows and you look at Perfmon, we see long device queues. A disk bottleneck tends to be accompanied by low to middle CPU utilization. So it tends to mean if I'm bottlenecked on the disk, the system isn't actually doing that much in terms of CPU. CPU bottlenecks are probably the second most common resource bottleneck that we run into. Basic symptom, of course, would be total CPU utilization on the system getting up near 100%. That would be a very busy system. We can also see cases where one CPU is completely saturated by a single-threaded application. For example, if you have a batch application that's just doing one job, it's got to get done, nothing else is going on the machine, that could cause one CPU to be completely utilized. And if it was on, say, a four-way machine, the overall machine might seem to be 75% idle, but if that one CPU is my bottleneck, then I've got a CPU bottleneck. Moving on to page 11, the other couple of types of resource bottlenecks, memory and network. Now, memory is an interesting one. So the basic symptoms of that, we're going to show up as low amount of free memory in VMstat, etc., swapping activity on the system, either reported as swapping activity or activity on a swap disk. Higher than normal system CPU time. Generally, we'd see, you know, on a healthy AIX system, you might see about one-fifth of the CPU being used is system and about four-fifths is user time. And if that climbs much above that, that's a sign that there's something going on in the operating system that we might want to look into. And a memory bottleneck can stimulate that kind of a symptom. Now, the interesting thing I mentioned about memory bottlenecks is they often masquerade as a CPU problem or a disk problem. If you run out of memory, like I mentioned, you could end up having extra system CPU time, and so that might start to look like a CPU problem. Or if you start swapping, you start seeing a lot of disk I/O, might start to look like a disk problem. It's a memory bottlenecks are a bit of a chameleon. Network bottlenecks, we'll get to the symptoms of those later on. They tend to be a little bit less common than CPU and disk and even memory, but they still do happen. The other major type of bottleneck would be what I call a non-resource bottleneck. And these are things that aren't sort of, an example of that is a locking bottleneck. Now, locks are resources, absolutely, but it's not really a shortage of locks that's causing the problem. It's the fact that if we have lock contention, for example, or if we have, you know, other different types of contention within the system, that can cause a performance slowdown. And so that's what I categorize here as a non-resource bottleneck. Symptom of a locking problem would be high total lock wait time, many processes in a lock wait state in a DBT snapshot, and generally low CPU consumption. Last but not least, and I'm not really going to talk about this too much, is sort of external factors. If, for example, I have a slowdown on an application server driving the database, that might seem like my overall database performance is dropping, but it could be because of that external factor. Okay, I'm going to move on to page 12, and it gets us into probably the biggest section of the talk, which is about disk bottleneck. On page 13, we get into, the best bottleneck is a bottleneck that you don't have to experience. So if we can avoid it in the first place, let's do that. And that comes from good planning. First of all, we've got to make sure that I/O subsystem capacity matches your needs, and plus a margin if you can afford it. And I don't mean in gigabytes or terabytes or petabytes even. I mean in operations per second or megabytes per second. So really what it gets down to, the factors affecting that are things like number of disks. Modern CPUs just get faster and faster and faster on a completely different scale than disks do. Disks get bigger, and they get somewhat faster, but not at nearly the same rate that CPUs do. So we can't forget, when you get your first terabyte disk drive, it's still one spindle and one set of heads, and that's an important thing to remember. Raid striping can also be important to reduce the response time and improve the throughput of disk I.O. And modern controllers tend to have a whole boatload of memory on them so that fewer I.O.s actually have to go to or come from the disk itself. And that can really speed up transactional I.O. as well. Another very important factor in avoiding disk bottlenecks, as well as subsystem capacity, is data placements. And that is getting more and more complex. The more layers of abstraction we have nowadays, RAID stripes, volume groups, logical volumes, all these different things, that can make it more difficult to know where your data is going. You know, it's 11 o'clock. Do you know where your data is? And that's getting tough these days. It's difficult to lay things out in an organized fashion, but it will pay off later. The simplest approach, and it works pretty well, kind of on an 80-20 kind of thing, is to just spread all data in indexes over all disks to avoid hotspots. Works pretty well, is very easy to set up. It has some drawbacks, absolutely, but it's a decent configuration. The one caveat there would be to keep the transaction log separate. Moving on to slide 14. On mapping layers of storage. So, yeah, it's difficult to see where things are, but this gives us a little bit of an idea how to track them down in sort of the scope of DB2. The first bullet is about mapping devices to file systems. So here's just a simple example coming from AIX, that if for example, IO stat is showing that this disk called HDisk 43 is busy, I can find out where it's mounted by using LSPV, and it tells me I'm mounted on /home. And if a DB2 workload is driving heavy activity on /home, that's probably something I want to look into right away, because that's probably not what I intended. Moving further down, mapping how to map different types of DB2 entities onto file systems or devices. Well, logs, that's easy. We just go into the database configuration, and we look for path to log files. Containers, we have three different choices. If we have a particular table space ID, we can just list table space containers for that ID. Or I can use the snapshot container table function wrapper and just get it through SQL. I can select star from snapshot container, and it will give me all the containers for all my table spaces in one go, which is a pretty efficient way to do it. Or I could even just go back to DB2 look output. What about utility files? How do we find out where utility files are? Because they can be a real consumer of I.O. cycles as well. We want to make sure that load input data, message file, backup, image, etc., are being read and written in the places that I intended them to be, i.e. not on /home or /temp, for example. But the location of those is going to be dependent on how the utility was invoked. So I'm going to need to go back to a list utility show detail kind of thing to figure out where those things are. All right, on page 15, getting into the first type of disk bottleneck, a data table space. So on the left-hand side of the page, you'll see this decision tree branch that we're growing. Yes, it's a real problem, starting at the bottom and moving up. Yes, it's a real problem. The bottleneck type is disk. The type of disk, well, it's a data table space disk. All right. So the first question I want to ask myself at the top of the page here, what tables are in that table space? And the easiest way to do that is I'm just going to go into syscat.tables and do a simple query on give me table space table names, pardon me, where the table space ID matches the table space ID for the hot container that I got on the previous page. So now I have a list of tables. Well, which tables are hottest? I can now go into the snapshot. I can either get a table snapshot from the command line, or I can use the snapshot table table function wrapper, as I've got here as an example, to go in and figure out to fetch the table name and the rows read for all the tables in this hot table space. And I can order it by the number of rows read. So this way I can go straight into the snapshot data and figure out the hottest tables in that table space. So now I've got the disk narrowed down, I've got the table space narrowed down, I've got one or more tables narrowed down. Now what about the SQL that's driving that activity? Well, first of all, I can look at dynamic SQL. That's really straightforward. I can go into a dynamic SQL snapshot, or I can go into the table function wrapper like I've got here in this example. The table function wrapper is called snapshot_dyn_SQL. and I can pull that stuff out. I can pull out all kinds of amazing information about these SQL statements. Number of rows read, user CPU time spent, system CPU time spent, execution time. I can pull out a ton of good information there to figure out which of my dynamic SQL statements might be driving the table, which is in the hot table space, which is on the hot disk. See, we're narrowing things down. We've gone from sort of the generic disk bottleneck problem all the way down to a particular SQL statement fairly quickly. So on page 16, just a slightly different flavor of the previous page, what if it's a static SQL statement that's causing the problem? How do I get at that? You know, we don't have a static SQL snapshot, but I can get it through an event monitor. And here's a short list of steps in order to get that. So I'm going to create an event monitor. I'm going to turn it on, catch some activity, and then I'm going to start analyzing my event monitor output with simple SQL to figure out what is, to pull out the statements that are touching the table that I'm interested in. So if it's table T, I would say, you know, bring me back all SQL that contains for example, percent T percent. That's not a good example because T is too short a name. But if it was a table name like orders or history or new order or something like that, it would be very sensitive as a way of picking out the SQL I was interested in. If you're shy of event monitors because they're quite heavy load on the system, you can look in the appendix, and there's a few pages in the appendix of this presentation about how to create a low overhead event monitor. We're going to get lots of data. We're going to use statement type equals two in the query in the yellow box there to mean static SQL only. And again, we can use order by and where clauses, etc., to pick out the rows that we want and to order them in descending order of CPU utilization or rows read or elapsed time or any of the other different metrics that we can get out of statement event monitor. Very powerful stuff. Okay, on page 17, now we've narrowed it down to an SQL statement on a table in a data table space, et cetera, et cetera. What if it's a select? Well, what could be the problem? Well, question number one is, am I getting an unwanted table scan? And symptoms of that would be, in the snapshot, I would see rows read much higher than the number of executions of that statement, indicating that each execution has to read a whole bunch of rows. I can confirm the plan by going into DB2 Explain, I can also get information about table scans out of DB2 PD. There's good information in DB2 PD about that as well. If it's a single table scan, I'm not too worried about that. If this is a repeated query rather than ad hoc, then this is kind of what I want to zero in on, because I'm going to be paying this unwanted table scan price over and over and over, and it makes it worth trying to go after. How do we get rid of this unwanted table scan? Well, maybe I have old statistics. Well, if I have old or inaccurate statistics, that could cause the optimizer to choose a table scan. And I may not have the right index on this table to suit the SQL that I'm running against it. And I've got the DB2 Configuration Advisor here, which is the old name. It's the DB2 Design Advisor, may be able to help me choose a better set of indexes or even a single index to help me get rid of that unwanted table scan. Now, not all table scans are unavoidable. If it's an ad hoc query, even if it's repeated, I can't necessarily index every field. So if it's unavoidable, one possible problem might be that it's not being prefetched. So if the prefetcher can't keep up, the agent is going to have to be doing that table scan itself, and that's really inefficient. How do we know if this is happening? Well, if we get a table space snapshot, we can look and compare the number of asynchronous pool data page reads, meaning pages read by the prefetcher, and we can compare them with all, you know, the total number of reads. And if there's more than a trivial number not being asynchronous, then that means the agent is having to read them, and that could be expensive. You can also see this as another symptom of inefficient or unsuccessful prefetching is a high amount of time spent waiting on prefetcher, also out of the snapshot. So depending on how many prefetchers you have defined, you might want to look at, if you're in this case, you might want to look at increasing num.io servers. Other possibilities for reducing the amount of table scanning I have to do, possibly creating a materialized query table or MQT to eliminate aggregate recalculation, and also MDCs, multidimensional clustering, can help significantly reduce the size of a scan. And both of those are going to be can be recommended by the design advisor. All right, page 18, we kind of look at the other side of the coin, which is writes to a data table space. The process is quite similar to reads, but the interesting thing is that a true write-blocked SQL statement is relatively rare, and that's because almost all writes are asynchronous via the buffer pool. The data goes into the buffer pool, and the page cleaner will clean it out at a later time, long after the agent has moved on to other things. So your connection is rarely blocked behind a write, but it can happen. One time it can happen, for example, is if you have long varchars or lob in this hot insert or update statement. SMS or DMS file containers may help by taking advantage of file system caching. So if I make sure that I use SMS or DMS file for my lob table space, the file system cache may help me out. Another possibility of generating writes is by the page cleaners themselves, and that could be a sign that DB2 is cleaning too aggressively. If I set softmax, these are database configuration parameters, if I set softmax or change pages thresh very low, two things will happen. First of all, I will get quicker recovery, which is good. If my system goes down, it will help me. Setting those parameters low will help the system come up quickly, but it also gives me potentially a high load due to cleaning and re-cleaning the same page if it's being updated multiple times. If I'm cleaning too aggressively, I might see in the snapshot an excessive number of dirty page threshold and LSN gap cleaner triggers. So if you're how to deal with this, if your recovery requirements are not sort of superhuman, if you don't have to be back up in 5 seconds or less kind of thing, then you might want to consider dropping those parameters somewhat, see if that alleviates this write bottleneck on a data table space. This bottleneck number two on page 19 would be an index table space. So we've pretty well beaten data table spaces to death. So now we're going to look at index table spaces. Again, a lot in common with the data table space approach, but it's more difficult to detect and affect because the use of indexes is something that the optimizer is going to decide. And, you know, if and how they are used may change if the plan changes. It's not something that's explicitly specified in the SQL statement. So I can't just go mining my SQL statement looking for one that uses an index. So here what I might want to do is look at the access plans for my system and look for any that have large index scans or statements large or in the snapshot, do I have statements with large numbers of index physical reads? And again, if I'm having questions or issues about how my indexes are designed and configured and are being used, I might want to use the design advisor to get its opinion on how my indexes are configured. Now, on page 20, we're moving on to disk bottleneck number three. So we've gone through data table spaces and index table spaces. And that brings us to the obvious third type, which is temporary table spaces. The activity on those is typically driven by spilled sorts that can be contained in memory, and intermediate result sets if I'm running complex SQL. So question number one, are a lot of sorts spilling to disk? A small number is probably not causing a bottleneck. So we're looking for big numbers here. I want to look at the snapshot and look for large numbers of sort overflows and high sort time statistics. Those are indications of that sorts may be causing my problem. So if it does look like that sorting is an issue, then sort heap may be set too low, or sort heap thresh might be improperly set for the combination of sort of concurrent connections, concurrent activity that's going on in my system. Now the good thing is that small increases in sort heap can have a positive impact on the efficiency of sorting. You know, if I increase my sort heap by 10%, that should have an impact on whether or not I spill sorts. Not all heaps are like that, so that's a good thing about sort heap. This is less of an issue now with if you're using self-tuning memory management and you've got store heat being automatically tuned. But many people have systems that have come that are coming up through version 8 and earlier versions that don't have store heat set to be automatic. So this is still something to be considered. Further down, you know, I may be getting sorts and intermediate result sets. Maybe coming from poor plans. Like just like we can get table spaces inadvertently. We might be getting sorts and intermediate result sets, sorts and temping, because of poor plans. So I can see the sort and runtime statistics for individual statements, for example, in the dynamic SQL snapshot. And then again, you know, I can go back to the design advisor, and it may help me create additional indexes to resolve my, you know, to be able to avoid sorting and intermediate result sets. All right, so on page 21, now we've kind of backed off a little bit here. We've gone into the three different types of table spaces, but what if it's not a problem or something that I can fix with SQL? What if it's a configuration issue? So no utility is running, I have no hot statements, you know, now it's time to look at the configuration. Well, if it's not, if I don't have, you know, one really, really hot statement, do I have a group of fairly hot statements that are, or, you know, in this case, tables in the table space? Same idea. So if I've got reasonably active tables and they're all in the same table space, that may be driving too much I.O. to the disks where that table space lives. So a solution to that might be splitting up the tables into separate table spaces. Are there too many table spaces on these disks? You know, if I have an assortment of relatively busy table spaces, are they coexisting on the same set of disks, and again driving up the number of IOs as a total and causing that disk bottleneck? So we may want to relocate. You know, if that was the case, I would look at that by moving table spaces onto other disks. If I've done my layout in DB2 all correctly, if there's nothing unintentional going on in DB2 or at the table level, etc., I may have an unintentional overlap of table spaces on disks. And this can happen kind of at the operating system level. I may have two different, for example, I might have two different devices or two different file systems that when I configured my database, I believed were on separate sets of drives, but perhaps they weren't. Perhaps they were actually sharing spindles. And this can cause essentially what is crosstalk in the activity, you know, sort of an unintended side effect of activity in one table space is going to impact another one. And that, again, gets back to the advantage of having a good idea of how your database is laid out on disk, why it's important to understand the storage configuration up front. Moving on to page 22, well, finally we've got to the point where if my DB2 configuration is correct and my disk layout is as good as I can possibly get it, then I may finally be to the point where I have to buy more disk. Additional capacity, et cetera, may be required. More memory, for example, may help random IO, but not as likely to help table scans. I mean, it could help sort heap, for example, but extra memory is sort of well known to help buffer pools in OLTP configuration. Again, the basic rule of thumb for disk configurations that we've suggested for a long time is 10 to 15 disks per CPU. And nowadays with SAN configurations, that might be a meaningless recommendation since you're not thinking in spindles but in drawers of SAN capacity. But really, we want to make sure that we can see within the SAN or we can test on the SAN to verify that we're getting roughly equivalent performance in operations per second, something equivalent to 10 to 15 disks per CPU. All right, moving on to page 23. We've done containers. We've gone through that pretty thoroughly. The last type of disk bottleneck I want to look at is transaction logs. And this can be very sensitive. This can have a lot of influence on the performance of an OLTP system, especially, so we want to pay some attention to this. This is a good place to use your best hardware. It doesn't take a lot of it, but this is a good place to use, you know, dedicated disks, as in keep them separate from table spaces, keep them separate from application data if you can. You know, we want to keep these separate. It doesn't take many. Keep them separate. Use fast disks. Use RAID parallelization with a small stripe size, so that because the logger is typically writing small IOs, you know, multiples of 4K, but not enormous amounts of data generally. So a small stripe size is going to make sure that in the RAID, in the multi-disk RAID configuration, I've got more than one disk working on my IO in general. Also might want to look at fast controllers with write caching, so that if my controller has a battery backup, it needs to for the log, because the log needs to be fault tolerant, if you will. A fast battery backup controller with write caching is going to give me very fast log I/O times. It's going to really improve my log I/O response time. If I am seeing a problem here, is anything using the same disk? You know, I've recommended these to be dedicated, so we check that. Is anything using the same disk? It can be difficult to determine for a lot of the reasons we talked about earlier on, about partition disks, logical volumes, etc. In the DB2 sense, we want to make sure that the table space container path, database directory, utility files, etc., none of that is residing on the same drive. For non-DB2 files, we can look at tools like FileMon on AIX or Truss or S-Trace on Sun and Linux, respectively, as a way of finding out what I/O operations are going to those disks. On page 24, one sort of subtype of problem, if I'm not having a problem on my log disk because the spindles are being shared by something else, am I having a problem due to high transaction rate? And that's going to show up in IOSTAT, which is just a tool on Unix that gives me the activity level on all my devices. If IOSTAT shows more than, say, about 80 IOs per second on a single drive, or higher numbers on a RAID stripe set, of course, but if it shows that and it shows small average size, like a 4K per IO, then that's showing that I'm doing lots of individual log IOs out to the disk. How could we address that? Well, you might be able to reduce commit frequency. If you're running, for example, if you're running applications with auto commit, that can cause a lot of sort of chatter in the transaction log subsystem, because we're going to be doing just tons and tons of commits and flushes out to the disk, etc. The database snapshot will provide information on how to whether or not you're seeing a whole bunch of commits. And we can also then go down into the application snapshot to find out which applications are doing this very frequent committing. And there may be a way, it may be possible in the application to address that. Another possibility is that the log buffer size might be too small. The log has to flush the buffer when it gets full. The default size is 8 pages, which is 8 4K pages. That's a very small amount of memory on most systems. And really, that's too small. Autoconfigure will increase that, but if you're not using autoconfigure, then you might want to increase that to, say, 128, 512 pages, etc., just as a ballpark figure. In 8.2, there were log monitor elements added to the snapshot, so you can actually go and see if this is your problem. It will say, number of log full, log buffer full conditions. And if that is not zero, then we're flushing the log buffer for the wrong reason. And increasing the size might be helpful. The last bullet on here, and this is almost a little bit controversial now. We've done a lot with the logger over the years to make min commit a parameter that you very, very rarely have to touch as of about version 8. Basically, it batches commits together. It's really only effective when you've got many, as in hundreds of applications, all committing very frequently. And it will essentially, if I have min commit set to 3, it will wait until 3 commits come in before any of them are flushed to disk. So that will reduce the number of IOs to disk, but it can cause some back pressure into my system by increasing the commit time for some of my agents. So again, this would be a bit of a long shot in fixing a transaction log, high transaction rate problem, but it is something to be aware of. On page 25, if it's not high transactions that's burying my transaction logs, is it high data volume? That's kind of the other side of the coin here. And that's going to show up in IOSTAT by larger average IO sizes, say greater than 8K, and probably smaller IO rates than what we saw before, so maybe 50 IOs per second or less. So if that's if that was my problem, then, you know, can I reduce the amount logged? For example, on an update statement, if it's possible for me to group together frequently updated columns, that will reduce the amount of data that has to be logged. For example, if the first column and the tenth column are both being updated, DB2 will log everything from the first to the tenth and all eight columns in between. If those two columns are right next to each other in the row, DB2 will only log those two columns. So that's a length that not a lot of people go to, but that will help reduce the amount of data logged due to updates. Another big hitter for volume of data logged is large objects. So not everybody can, but many applications can use not logged logs. So if the database is managing logs, say for example documents, for instance, that are also stored external to the database, so that I don't need to be able to recover them, then I may be able to use not logged logs. What about bulk operations? So for example, an insert subselect from one table into another. Say I'm doing a batch data transfer within my system. So I might be able to use the alter table not logged initially to say, you know what, I'm doing a bulk operation. If I have to recover this, I can. I don't depend on being able to recover this insert subselect in the middle of the operation. So I might be able to use not logged initially to reduce the amount of log activity there. On the second half of page 25, just some basic rules of thumb for log disk configuration. So as a basic configuration, consider a pair of dedicated RAID 1 log disks. So a RAID 1 is mirroring, so we have two disks with exact same writes going to each disk, so we have better fault tolerance, for up to about 400 DB2 transactions per second. If we go higher than that, then we would probably want to go to a RAID 10, which is a mirror of stripes of multiple disks with an 8K stripe size. So up to about 400, you should be able to get away with a single disk if you need to. Beyond that, go to mirrors of stripes. The number of log disks, the amount of write buffering required, all of these different things. The configuration is highly dependent on the transaction rate, the number of write transactions per second, all kinds of things. But these are reasonable rules of thumb to start off with. All right, and on page 26, we kind of have the 10,000-foot view of the disk bottleneck diagnosis that we've gone through. So we started at the bottom. What kind of bottleneck type was it? Well, it was a disk bottleneck. And then from there, we split it into four different types. Is it data table space, index table space, temp table space, or a log device? And each one of those, there's some overlap, but in general, each one of those has a separate strategy of attack on the problem. So that's why it pays off to figure out early on, you know, which table space is it? Is it a data table space? And to be able to just drill down on the things that are affecting that and be able to essentially ignore or at least delay investigation into other areas of the system. All right. So on page 27, we're moving from disk bottlenecks into CPU bottlenecks. A CPU bottleneck on most database systems is generally less common than a disk bottleneck. Databases are all about data and disks, and most systems, many systems nowadays, a lot of systems tend to be under-configured on disk, and so that's why we see more disk bottlenecks. CPU bottlenecks can happen. We can break down a high CPU utilization system different ways. We can break it down by application through the snapshot for applications. We can break it down by dynamic SQL statements by the dynamic SQL snapshot, and we can break it down by static SQL or SQL store procedures by looking at statement event monitor output. And that's a good basic way of narrowing things down fairly quickly. Page 28. The first thing I like to check for if I see a high CPU bottleneck is to look for if are there small selects in the system that are frequently executed that are consuming a fair bit of CPU and have a high number of rows read, each one. And those are kind of the symptoms of an in-memory table scan. Not all table scans necessarily go up to disk. We can have in-buffer pool table scans. And if they're frequently executed, they can run pretty fast, but they chew up CPU like you wouldn't believe. And so You know, if you've got one of those and you've got a CPU problem, then going to the DB2 Design Advisor may be a good step because it might be able to help you choose an index on that table to avoid a table scan. It might not help the response time of the statements using that table, but it should cut CPU utilization pretty dramatically. Okay, on page 29, other possible causes of CPU bottleneck are, a good example is repeated lightweight dynamic SQL. So this is not ad hoc. This is sort of transactional dynamic SQL. Do you have applications that use literals instead of parameter markers? Well, what that causes, DB2 to have to recompile the statement every time it's used, and the dynamic SQL cache can't do its job. If you can use parameter markers, that will let DB2 cache the statement and dramatically reduce the amount of CPU that goes into compiling the SQL statement. Very handy stuff. Second point on the page here is, are dynamic SQL statements being re-prepared unnecessarily? And this is independent of whether or not they have parameter markers. You know, am I re-preparing the same statement over and over again? The dynamic SQL cache will save CPU time compared to recompiling a statement, but it still uses CPU, and we'd rather not use that if possible. So the best possible case, we want to prepare a dynamic SQL statement once, hold on to the handle and reuse it, and not even try to prepare it. Just backing up again for a second about package cache inserts. Now, if I'm re-preparing dynamic SQL fairly frequently, that may cause package cache inserts. Now, in the snapshot, you'll see three package cache statistics: package cache lookups, inserts, and overflows. Now, overflows is the one that sounds really sinister. It sounds like the one that you want to not have any of, and that's true. It's very heavy. But 99.9% of the time, that number will always be zero. That doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have a package cache problem. You should look at inserts as well. Now, an insert is essentially, you know, if I'm executing an SQL statement over and over again, re-preparing it, if the package cache is full, my statement might have been kicked out since it was last used. And if I go to re-prepare it, it's already been seen. It should be in the package cache, but it's been kicked out, and now it has to be recompiled. It will then be put back in the package cache and kick out something else. So we have this, in a transactional system, we can have this constant churn through the package cache. And that will show up as package cache inserts. And that's a sign that, again, in a transactional environment, that maybe your dynamic SQL cache isn't doing the job that it could be. And again, we might want to look at increasing the package cache size if we are seeing a substantial number of package cache inserts. On page 30, another fairly common problem with CPU consumption is short-lived connections. And these are the kind of things where we connect to the database, we do something, and we disconnect. And that can show up in web applications and some other kinds of sort of, I would say, more modern architectures. How do you know if you've got that? Well, if you do a snapshot, it will show a small number of commits. Even if the system's been running for a while, it will show a small number of commits because the connection's been going away. We also see that the connect time of all the applications is always very recent. That's a sign that connections are being dropped and recreated, and that's an expensive process. So if possible, we want to avoid that. The second point of the page here is, are only a subset of CPUs being saturated? And I mentioned this earlier on about the concept that if I've only got, you know, for example, a single-stream batch workload on the system, on a four-way, it could be totally saturating one CPU and still be CPU-bound, even though there's three CPUs just sitting there spinning idle. So, you know, one possible way around that, can I break up the work and parallelize it? You know, if it was batch, can I, say, break it up into four different sub-streams and have them each using one of my CPUs? Might want to explore SMP parallelism, that kind of thing, in order to make use of idle CPUs on my system. On page 31, we look at utilities as a cause of a CPU bottleneck. DB2 utilities can saturate CPU, absolutely. They are designed to be highly parallel and highly scalable. They are designed to grab resource and get the job done as quickly as possible, and they're very good at it. So we need to be aware that that's kind of their design point, and and react accordingly if that's causing a problem. So to see what utilities are going on, we get a DB2 list utilities output. We can also look at the processes on the system to see, you know, do I see load processes like the LRID, the RIDder, or the buffer manipulator, or formatter process. Do I see those chewing up lots of CPU time? That's a sign that there's a load somewhere that's using up a lot of CPU. I can control this by using throttling, which was introduced in DB2 not all that long ago. So there's a keyword called util impact priority on run stats and backup, for example. That will let me say I want to have no more than X percent impact to my system, say 10%, 20%, whatever, and then DB2 will throttle those utilities to make sure resources aren't hogged. On load, I can use the CPU parallelism keyword to restrict it from, you know, say, you know what, just don't go wild. You know, leave me some CPU to get my regular work done. Okay, on page 32, most of what we've been talking about in CPU up till now is about high user time. High system time is kind of generally has a different set of causes. So it helps to know early on, is my problem high system time or high user time? High activity in the operating system is often caused by sort of what we might call device management, especially older devices. You know, disk and, you know, older disks, for example, older Linux kernels had a very inefficient way of handling disk I/O when there was more than a gigabyte of memory in the system. And that's been fixed recently. But there are, you know, there are other similar, less severe problems with some drivers and some versions of different operating systems, etc. On the network side, if I'm doing a whole bunch of network stuff, every time a packet comes and goes, it's going to generate an interrupt that the operating system has to handle. So if I'm in an extremely high throughput network environment, you know, I've got clients just sending just a ton of data back and forth to the server, that can generate a lot of interrupts and cause high system CPU time. Possible answer to that would be, you know, perhaps a tow card that offloads a bunch of the TCP processing expense takes it off of the server and puts it on dedicated hardware on the adapter or RDMA adapters can cause less CPU load as well. On page 33, another cause of high system time, besides device management, is memory management. And this is kind of a separate thing because it can have a pretty broad effect. Do I have my system memory over-allocated? Have I, you know, told DB2 it can use, you know, 3.5 gig of memory when I only have 3 gig in the box, and that kind of thing? That's going to show up as swap activity, et cetera, in VMstat and the performance monitor. And I really, really want to avoid overcommitting system memory. It's just not smart. DB2 will not run particularly well. No application, no middleware will run well in an environment where system memory is overcommitted. We don't want the operating system getting in there and having to swap big chunks of memory out to disk just to allow for this overallocation. One interesting thing that's come up kind of in the last year or two with systems becoming more common that have huge amounts of memory, say 16 gig, 32 gig, 64 gig, are not rare systems anymore. They used to be something you'd see, you know, only in the absolute top-end labs, and there's plenty of customers now using systems with that much memory. Even just managing that memory is a heck of a job for the operating system kernel. The page size it deals with by default is, you know, down in the small number of K, 1K, 4K, that kind of thing. So that the operating system is actually managing millions of pages of memory at a time, and it's got to keep track of where they are and who owns what and what physical memory is backing what virtual address and all that stuff, and that's a very expensive proposition. Now, fortunately, in the last release or two of the top-end sort of enterprise Linux kernels, either, you know, both SUSE and Red Hat support this, is large page support, where the operating system can support, like, you know, gigabyte pages, you know, hundreds of megabyte size pages, so that the system is only managing, you know, a small number, a tiny fraction of the number of pages it used to have to manage, and that can make a dramatic difference in the in the amount of CPU consumed just to manage memory. So if you're running a system with 16 gig or more on Linux, you want to make sure that you've got that enabled. Okay, moving on to page 34. We talked about memory and devices. Another possible cause of high system time is process scheduling and management. So how do we detect this? Does the system have a high number of context switches? A context switch is the process that the operating system basically swaps out one, well, I'm not talking about disk swapping, but I'm talking about, you know, basically moves one process into the CPU, executes it, and then moves it out and moves in a different one. That is called a switch of context, and it's kind of an expensive operation. It's transparent. It happens under the covers, but if you get tens or hundreds of thousands of those happening every second, that can be a major consumer of CPU time. So if you go to VMstat on Unix and you look at the CS column, means context switch, if you're seeing more than about 75,000 of those per second, then that's a sign that you're starting to do a fairly high number of them. Now, how can we handle that? Well, something that can cause that is having a very high number of connections. You know, if you've got literally thousands of connections, that can cause high number of context switches, especially if it's short transactions. You might want to look at the connection concentrator. If I have short transactions and very frequent commits, each of those commits requires a context switch to the logger. And so if I can, if possible, lengthen the transactions, that may reduce the number of commits, that may reduce the number of context switches. Another possible cause of high system CPU consumption is processes coming and going, like being created and destroyed. That is a very, very expensive process at the operating system level. And that can be caused by depending on how numpool agents is set, numpool agents and max agents in your system. Numpool agents is the number of idle agents that can be sitting around on the system waiting for more work. If it's set very low, say for example, set to 100, and max agents is set to 1,000, and suppose I have about 500 connections on my system. So every time somebody drops the connection, the agent will be destroyed because it's above numpool agents. And then if a new connection comes in, it's got to create a new agent. That's an expensive process. We want to make sure that we're not doing too much of that agent thrashing. The important thing to note, though, this is really a trade-off because we're trading memory footprint for CPU. We're seeing high CPU due to frequent create and destroy of processes. So we're saying, well, we'll keep some around by increasing numpool agents, but that's going to consume more memory. And maybe you can afford that, maybe you can't. And that's something that is going to depend on the individual, and it's going to depend on the individual system. All right, on page 35 is our 10,000-foot view of our CPU bottleneck decision tree. You know, early on, we split left or right, depending on whether it was user time or system time, and then after that, we can look at different causes. So again, here's our decision tree splitting out, you know, helping us avoid spending time on one possible cause when the evidence doesn't support it. All right, page 36, we get into network bottlenecks. These really aren't very common, but they can happen. Like I mentioned earlier on, in an environment with very high client-server network traffic, you know, for example, a client load, utility, bulk data extraction, log manipulation, very high-rate OLTP, that kind of thing can really drive up the network activity. We want to make sure that configuration issues aren't getting in the way. For example, and this happens a lot, mismatched Ethernet transmission rates. For example, a client configured at 10 megabits per second and the server configured at 100, or vice versa. Now, it's amazing how often that causes, you know, that turns out to be the root cause of a performance problem. Definitely something that's worth checking if you suspect you have a network bottleneck. Another possible cause is other activity on a shared LAN. So, for example, if your client-server network is shared by, a storage network, or network-attached storage, that can cause excess network traffic that's going to get in the way of your DB2 client-server traffic. We talk about network time lower down the page here as being the response time seen at the client minus the response time seen at the server, and we can measure, for example, the client response time either by the application or a CLI trace or a Java trace, and the response time at the server measured either by dynamic SQL snapshot or statement event monitor. There's quotes here as I say this. If I see high numbers for that network time, then that's a sign that I may have a network bottleneck. And again, this is a case where you want to measure this when the system is running well, so you have something to compare it to, so that when I say high, it means something in your environment. Ping is actually a very useful tool for measuring network lag. It works pretty well. And then if I see that my network time is dominating my client response time, that's a sign I've got a network bottleneck. And there may be spikes in network time coinciding with different phases of the workload, other activity going on in the network, etc. Moving on to page 37, what can we do about a network bottleneck? Well, one possibility, if it's due to excessive client-server traffic, might be to push some client logic onto the server to reduce traffic, either through, for example, stored procedures, user-defined functions, or a more sophisticated SQL. For example, we've got some really amazing select from insert, or update through select. There's all kinds of very powerful new SQL that's been introduced into DB2 in recent releases. And even just something as simple as pushing a predicate down onto the down into the SQL to filter result sets at the server. Now, again, of course, what we're doing by this is we're pushing work onto the server, and so that may shift us away from a network bottleneck into a CPU bottleneck on the server. So we need to take into account how much excess capacity we have at the server to absorb that client logic being exported. Page 38 shows us our very simple network bottleneck diagnosis tree. In this case, it's tall and skinny like bamboo, so it's colored green. If we take, I was going to say we're going to put them all together, but we're not. That comes later. Next, on page 39, comes lazy system bottlenecks. This is my favorite one because it often causes, it's the least obvious one, and it often causes problems. Sometimes resource bottlenecks are easier to solve than these lazy system bottlenecks. It's the last variety of bottleneck we're going to look at today. So what's a lazy system? Well, it's slow but has no obvious external symptoms. For example, I'm trying to push my system harder, but I seem to have spare CPU and spare disk, and I'm not memory bottlenecked, and the network isn't saturated, and all my resources seem fine, but I still can't drive my system any harder. These are difficult to find and solve, which is kind of why I've separated them out into a different category today. Common culprit number one is definitely lock contention. How do we tell if this is what's causing our problem? Well, if there's a significant amount of lock contention activity shown in the snapshots, either lock wait time, number of lock escalations, number of agents waiting on locks, those are all signs that locks may be a significant factor in my system. If I use application snapshots and lock snapshots, that'll help me break down my overall locking picture into individual packages and statements and users, and that can help me sort of really narrow down on the root cause of the problem. Going on to page 40, continuing on with locks as a lazy system bottleneck, it may be caused by an inadequately sized lock list or max locks. If those are too low, I can get lock escalations, and then table locks can get in the way of other activity, and now I can start to develop a traffic jam on my system with things with a big tree of lock weights behind it. So increasing lock lists or increasing max locks may get around that. If I have a convention, one thing that can help if I'm running a sort of a family of applications in my environment, having a convention on the order of how I access the data may help avoid deadlocks. For example, if I have a convention that all applications are going to go after the customer table first, then the stock table, etc., then I can avoid deadlocks happening by two applications going for the same data but in opposite order. Scanning rows in repeatable read will end up leaving all the rows locked. So many customers feel they need to run a repeatable read isolation, which is is pretty heavy, but if I have scans that are going to look at a whole bunch of rows, it's going to leave a whole bunch of rows locked, and that may cause further locking problems. It may help if I can push selection criteria down into DB2 to minimize the number of excess row locked. The two examples here, for example, on the left, I'm bringing back all these rows through a cursor and then sort of qualifying them at the client. I'm sort of cherry-picking rows at the client, but I'm leaving all these rows locked. If instead I can push that qualification down into the server, then I will touch fewer rows. I will end up leaving fewer rows locked. We'll be going to page 41. As well as locks, another possible cause of lazy system bottlenecks is agent I/O. So prefetchers and page cleaners are way more efficient for doing I/O than DB2 agents are. That's what they're designed to do. And systems work best if we leave the bulk of the I/O to prefetchers and page cleaners. So I want to check and see, is my system getting more than a trivial number of dirty page steal triggers or more than a trivial number of synchronous writes? Both of those can indicate that I have inadequate page cleaning going on. I might want to look at increasing the number of page cleaners I have or in decreasing softmax and change or change pages thresh to keep the cleaners working more steadily. I want to make sure that I have a reasonable supply of clean pages on my system so that the agent doesn't have to stop and clean a page itself before it can use one. Now here's an interesting sort of did you know thing. Did you know that cleaners can be required even in query-only environments? So if you've got a data warehouse environment where you're doing nothing but selects, you still need page cleaners in order to flush large temporary data to disk. If you don't have any page cleaners defined, then the agents are going to have to do it and your performance can suffer dramatically. Page 42, the flip side of agent I/O is, am I doing a bunch of scanning? And if I'm doing scanning of large tables and indexes, I want to make sure that I'm getting that work is being done by prefetchers. So if I look at, if I see a significant amount of time waited for prefetch in database snapshot, or buffer pool physical reads being higher than asynchronous pool data reads. Basically, am I doing more IOs than I am doing asynchronous IOs? In a complex query system where I'm doing lots of sort of BI type work, I want to make sure that the page cleaners are doing my IO, which means that almost all my reads are going to be asynchronous. If they're not, then I might want to look at increasing the number of I/O servers. Having too many I/O servers, the downside of that is not huge. They will just sit there waiting for work that doesn't come. They will use up memory footprint, yes, but the penalty of having too many is not that great, so it's better to have a few too many than to have too few. One per disk is an upper bound if you're in a non-RAID configuration, which are extremely rare nowadays. If you have if you have RAID configurations, you know, for example, a small handful of prefetchers per RAID device might be a way of looking at it in a non-JBOD configuration. Once you increase the number of I/O servers, you want to have a look at that, and if there are consistently a set of I/O servers or prefetchers that are not accumulating CPU time, then that means you've gone too far. You've got too many. So at that point, you could back the number of I/O servers back down. Another did you know here down at the bottom of the page. Prefetchers are required, even if you've got a pure OLTP system and you think you're doing nothing but random I/O, the prefetchers are actually I/O servers, and they're used for other things such as create, index, backup, and even restore. So if you've got an OLTP system with the absolute minimum number of prefetchers defined, you may find that create, index, backup, and restore, for example, don't perform as well as they could, as well as they would if you had more I/O servers defined. On page 43, the next lazy system bottleneck cause would be an application issue. It's not always DB2's fault. It may seem like it, but it's not always our fault. The question is the application driving the database hard enough? And in a complex multi-tier system where you've got, you know, end clients and you've got web servers and you've got application servers and a database and all that kind of thing that could be an upstream problem that is just not pushing DB2 very hard, how do we tell? Well, if we go into an application snapshot, if it shows that many or most of the DB2 agents are waiting for work, and that's the status UOW unit of work waiting, or if I look into the event monitor and I can tell from the statement event monitor that more time that I can measure in the event monitor how much time is being spent in the application side. If I'm seeing high numbers in either of those, that tends to mean that the problem is above DB2. It's sort of on the application side. So we might want to address that, might want to look at application and client side for bottleneck. And, you know, if possible, if sensible, increase application parallelism. If I can bring more active connections in, that may help me, you know, exploit database resources more efficiently. Page 44, the next possible cause is append contention. Almost all of these are contention-based. And if I have, for example, a whole bunch of connections coming in and sort of doing bulk inserts into a single table, that can cause contention within DB2 as those agents are sort of fighting for a place to put their row. And this can be particularly common in what you might think of as an insert-only table, you know, where you're recording activity, you know, orders or order line history kind of tables, where you're just going to be accumulating things and not deleting them. If the execution time for those statements is higher than it should be, you know, higher than you want it to be, or higher than when the system was healthy, you might want to consider setting append mode on the table, and that eliminates the free space search and dramatically simplifies the code that DB2 has to go through in order to find a location, a home for the new row. Now, if you turn append mode off again, you should be aware that you have to do a table reorg to rebuild the free space map. So just turning it off isn't really enough. You've got to turn it off and do a reorg, and then you're back to the default free space search algorithm that DB2 uses. Okay, page 45, min commit too high. Now, again, you know, earlier on in the presentation, I talked about min commit too low. Now I'm going to talk about min commit too high. This is the downside of min commit, that if sometimes people play around with it and they leave it at a high number, and then the system comes to a period of less activity, and then that min commit really starts to become a problem. So how do we tell? Is min commit maybe greater than 1 or 2% of the typical active OLTP connections? So if min commit is 2, you know, I should be looking at a system of 100 to 200 active OLTP connections. If it's any less than that, then min commit of 2 is probably too high. That's just as an example. My commit times are higher than they should be, but the log isn't busy, that may be a sign that the committing applications are having to wait for this min commit requirement to be met. You know, so the general rule of thumb is to reduce min commit back to 1. If the system performance drops, then try slowly increasing min commit by, you know, 1 at a time. Let's go from 1 to 2 to 3, etc. And stop when the performance stops improving. For almost all workloads, min commit equals 1, which is the default, works the best. Okay, on page 46, here's our we have another skinny problem diagnosis tree for our lazy system bottlenecks. And then on page 47, here's where we put them all together. So this is what the whole decision tree looks like. So we started down at the bottom with what is our basic bottleneck type. We broke it up into disk or CPU or network or lazy system. And then in each of those cases, we tried to break down the problem into broad categories before we got into specific solutions. You know, we got closer to the part of the dartboard that we wanted to aim at, step right up as close as we can before we threw our dart. And that was, you know, to get back to the dartboard analogy, that's what we're doing here. That's the whole idea is ruling out possible causes that can't be, you know, ruling out solutions that can't possibly fix the problem that we've got. You know, the 20 questions, animal, vegetable, mineral, we don't guess animals if it's a vegetable. Okay, on page 48, we're coming towards the end here. So in summary, you know, we've gone through a whole bunch of stuff today that, you know, in the end, it may seem pretty simple. And that's the beauty of it. It's a very simple, straightforward way to put together all the different possible causes and effects, problems and solutions that you know of for performance problems. We start at the highest possible level. We make the most basic decisions first before we start applying fixes. We change one thing at a time. We stop and think. And then by following this kind of decision tree approach, you'd be surprised how quickly and how you know, with what degree of confidence you can get from experiencing a performance problem to knowing what the solution is. It really works very well. And with that, I'm gonna turn it back over to Dave, the operator. I think he's got a poll to do, and then we can open up for question and answer.
Very much, sir. At this time, we will conduct a brief electronic survey. After I have finished reading the entire question and all of the possible responses, please answer by firmly pressing the star key followed by the number on your touch-tone telephone that corresponds with your choice. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. There will be a brief pause between each question to allow everyone a chance to respond. Let's begin. Question one. The level of detail in this presentation was, for about right, press star 1. For not technical enough, press star 2. For too technical, press star 3. Question 2. The speaker for this teleconference was, for excellent, press star 1, for good, press star 2, for fair, press star 3, for poor, press star 4. Question 3. Overall teleconference rating. For excellent, press star 1. For good, press star 2. For fair, press star 3. For poor, press star 4. Question 4. Would you like someone from IBM to contact you regarding DB29? For yes, press star 1. For no, press star 2. And this concludes our poll. We will now move on to our question and answer session. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you'd like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. Once again, if you're using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off. We will proceed in the order that you signal us, and we'll take as many questions as time permits. Once again, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone now to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal. And we'll take our first question today from Mark Dosen.
Bill, yes, my question is the page cleaning. You know, I've heard that asynchronous page cleaning is a great thing and over-aggressive page cleaning is a bad thing. And I'm trying to find out, when do you know what's balanced to strike?
Okay, so that's a good question. Basically, we get back to the change pages thresh and softmax parameters. And if those are set too low, then you're going to see in the snapshots you're going to see an awful lot of change pages an awful lot of dirty seal triggers and dirty page threshold triggers, etc. Now, if By awful lot, what do I mean? Well, if you're seeing high write activity to your table spaces, higher than kind of the front, if your workload is, say, 30% write and 70% read, then if you're seeing more than 30% of the I.O. to the disks being writes, then that means you're cleaning you're basically cleaning multiple times. You're cleaning each page multiple times. And we don't really want to do that. So if you're seeing a high numbers for dirty page for triggers, then you might want to try increasing change pages fresh or softmax sort of incrementally, you know, maybe by softmax by a change pages fresh by 5%, for example. And you should see a slight drop in the number of triggers. What you want to avoid really is dirty steel triggers. Those are very expensive. So if you've got zero dirty steel triggers, you can try increasing change pages thresh and softmax. If you start to get dirty steel triggers, then you've gone too far, because that basically means that an agent needed a page, it couldn't find one, it had to use one that was dirty and clean it out itself, which is an expensive operation. We want to avoid that. So kind of the default sweet spot, if you will, would be the number of cleaners and the setting for change pages thresh and softmax that gets you just up to the point where you might start getting dirty steels, but not quite there. Does that make sense?
Yes, we're tracking the percentage of all of our page cleanings, what percentage is synchronous or bad page cleaners. And, you know, I was trying to get a sense of, you know, where should that percentage be. You know, we've gotten it down in most systems below 20%, sometimes below 10%. Then there's the concern of, is that going too far, and are we getting over-aggressive page cleaning?
I would say in the 10 to 20% range is not bad. You know, if you pushed it down further, are you going to see an improvement? Probably not. If you let it go up higher than that, are you going to see an overall improvement in the behavior of the system? I would say probably not either. So that's probably about the right range.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
If you find that your question has been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. We'll go next to a question from Ira Feldman.
Yes, I was wondering what role, if any, does Leo have in database performance management, the DB2 Learning Optimizer? Is it worth the effort to implement that?
The Learning Optimizer is an awesome piece of technology that's going to have a larger and larger role in DB2 with successive releases. Now, the optimizer is a very critical, very important, and I would even say delicate piece of technology that we want to move slowly in. You know, we don't want to make drastic changes. So the initial releases of Leo are fairly limited in terms of what they can do. But the direction the direction we're heading is where we want to get to the point that the optimizer is able to, you know, spot differences between predicted cardinality and actual cardinality and make adjustments, et cetera. For now, it's going to be collecting, statistics on the fly, just-in-time statistics, that kind of thing, which is kind of more limited, but it's a step in the right direction. Whether or not, you know, to the degree that you want to use it in your environment would depend on the circumstances that you're in before Leo comes along. If you're seeing problems that could be helped by having, you know, the latest and greatest statistics in a particular area, then just-in-time statistics might be helpful in your environment. It's intended to be helpful. It's intended to be generally helpful, etc. Definitely. But in the end, any of these features, whether or not it works for you, is going to depend on, you know, how you use your environment, etc.
Yeah, I noticed that the learning process is painfully slow currently. I was just wondering what you're feeling for.
Again, I suppose it's the desire to be conservative, the desire
okay.
to not make, you know, radical changes that could cause more harm than good.
Thank you.
Okay.
And we'll go next to a question from William Meyer.
Yes. I was wondering what your advice would be on ERP systems with the tens of thousands of tables and huge numbers of table spaces. The standard tuning techniques don't seem applicable in those kinds of environments where you're looking at individual tables or table spaces. It's just, it's overwhelming. So do you have any advice on that?
Yeah, in that kind of an environment, you know, we see different extremes. We see the single table space approach. We see the one table space per table approach. Neither of those particularly works in that environment. So what we would generally advise in something like that would be to have, you know, split up by data and index, have one table space per page size. We've got a data and index split, we've got a page size split, and then there may be some smaller splits below that, depending on the number of rows in the table, or the desire, or whether or not the particular table, you know, you wanted to keep it in memory, or if it was something that was going to be growing a lot, and I didn't want it to overwhelm the buffer pool. So starting off with a basic split of index and data, and by page size. And then moving tables around as necessary, kind of the squeaky wheel, if you will. Moving those around as necessary is probably the best sort of rule of thumb approach. I'm not sure if you can hear me there.
Yes, unfortunately, I'm on a cell phone, but that's my question. Thanks for the answer.
Okay. You're welcome.
We'll move on to our next question from John Keener.
Yes, hello. My question basically would be about parallelization techniques I could use for a database that's primarily on SMS, and just hear some thoughts on that.
When you say parallelization, do you mean at the application level, or...?
Well, I was hoping it at the database level.
Okay. Is it an environment where you have multiple applications coming into the multiple database connections already?
Yes, we do.
And are you seeing contention? You said SMS, so are you seeing contention at the table space level or?
No, not really much contention. Just when you were talking about parallelization, you said if you see a lot of units of work that are waiting, and that's typically what we see. We only see one agent that's actively working, and all the rest of them are waiting.
Ah, okay. Well, it depends. So it depends what they're waiting on. So if you've got only one agent working, and the rest are waiting. If they're waiting on locks. Well, then that's something that you need to look at sort of the lock contention approach. I think when I brought that up during the presentation, that was in the context of, you know, you've got only one application if you've got 10 connections and only one is active and the others are in unit of work wait, you know, where they're back waiting on something to happen from the application. That was the context that I brought that up in during the presentation, but it really depends on the type of wait that you're experiencing.
Okay, so I should look harder at what the agents are actually looking
at. Yeah. See whether it's unit of work wait or lock wait or, you know, which one of these lazy system bottlenecks is keeping your other connections from getting work done.
All right, very good.
Okay.
Mr. Reese, we are past our end time. We still have about 5 questions remaining in our queue. Did you want to take one more before we end the call today?
I don't mind taking one more. That'd be fine.
Very good. We'll take that question from Sandy Cottingham.
Hi. I have some application developers that complain that queries will take 1 to 2 seconds to run the query, but it'll take like 10 seconds to get the results. If they're making those kind of complaints, do I look more then to see if it's I/O bound, or how would I root out why is it taking so long to get the results?
I guess what would help then would be to look at you know, that the initial kind of the first row response time or whatever would be typically the cursor being opened, the open coming back to the application. I've done the open, it only took 2 seconds, but then fetching the rest of the rows takes, you know, 10 more seconds or whatever. So assuming that it's that kind of a situation, that could be due to a few things. It could be due to a very large result set. It could be due to a network problem.
Okay.
It might be due to, again, it's probably more typically, going to happen when there's a larger result set, and that can be as a result of, that can come up due to I.O., it's possible. If you executed the same query multiple times and it was slow every time, then it's not I.O.
No, it's faster as you do it if you do it multiple times.
So that's an important piece of information. That probably rules out, for example, network, and which tends to be a bit more chaotic and a bit more, you know, it doesn't respond well to rerunning, whereas disk is something that typically does. Stuff gets into file system cache or the buffer pool, and then it runs faster multiple times. So that might be a case where, you know, increasing, assuming that it's just bringing stuff in from a data table space, then, you know, increasing buffer pool size, or looking at, you know, how busy the devices are, whether the read time from the device is fast. You know, if the slow instances of the query are consistent, depending on, you know, consistent regardless of, you know, what time of day it is or what else is going on in the system, then it might be a configuration issue more than a buffer pool issue, or more than a, you know, resource competition kind of issue. So it sounds like, based on what you say, it might be an IO, thing. That would be a good place to start.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And that does conclude today's conference call. We would like to thank everyone for taking the time to join us today. You may now disconnect.